Round the House is an estate of an adult. Therefore, nobody there and fear of this young man's case. I hope you won't mind if I talk to young people tonight. It's just too bad if you do, isn't it? May I take one of the illustrations? Some of them so obvious, they scarcely need referring to. This obvious one, I suppose, is in the realm of sexual morality. I almost say sexual immorality. But is there another revelation going on there? Long standards have been completely deadened. The old conventions have been swept away. And the way people are doing precisely what they should. They say quite deliberately, we no longer need those old requirements, those old standards. They are obsolete and out of date. To be told normally, that is more capable than simple destroyer. And here's the new psychology. I am all a judge whether that is responsible for the situation of a person's death. In all probability, it may be traced more clearly to a more recent cause. And the Joseph P. Fletcher and his book, Situation Ethics, and those that followed him. In my country, so, the John A. Robinson and his book, Honest to God. Which, quite frankly, is only a half digested form of Situation Ethics. But people of that kind who said quite deliberately, realize in their artificial system, that the old standards are no longer pertinent to the person's death. They belong to the past. Today we don't say, is what I propose to do right or wrong? That's totally irrelevant. What we do say is what I propose to do going to be done in a spirit of love? And secondly, will it affect detrimentally another person? Is what I propose to do is going to be done in a spirit of love? And if you would not affect someone detrimentally, then quite obviously, it's quite permissible for me to engage in that activity. So the premarital affairs, next to marital affairs, are quite permissible, even for the Christian. In fact, Joseph P. Fletcher, in one of his books, goes even farther. He says not only adultery, not only love, but in extreme cases, possibly murder also, might be perfectly permissible. That's the kind of world, the kind of society, in which we are living today. You wonder, I say, that we are in a state of a revolt. The effects, of course, are quite apparent. You can go to Sweden, for example, the most permissive society in Europe, you find that 10% of deaths are illegitimate. If you go to my country, you find that 20% of the brides who come to the altar are no longer virgins. If you go to America, USA, you'll find there are over 1 million abortions every year. If you go to country after country in the West, you find homosexuality and lesbianism viewed with a favorable eye. And today there are even gay or homosexual churches in your neighboring country. I would say this is the condition, the society in which we are living today. And quite patiently, in the realm of sexual morality, a revolution is going on, probably unparalleled in human history. Don't tell me patiently that conditions of this kind were here during the closing days of the Roman Empire. That's quite true, but not on the scale and not entirely of the pattern that one discovers at the present day. A revolution is going on, which quite bluntly is unparalleled in history. But if there is a revolt there, would it not be equally true to say that there is one in the field of biology also? There, I suppose, it started with artificial insemination. A bull in Scotland tried a whole herd in the Argentine without leaving its native country. So quite naturally, Scientists say, if we can do this kind of thing with brute beasts, why not with human beings also? And very shortly, we were introduced to all the mysteries of artificial insemination, not only by a husband, but by unknown donors as well. So that today, we are faced with possibilities that are almost frightening to those who pause to think. A man who has long been dead, may because of the storage in sperm banks, subsequently become the father of children, not only by his own daughter, but possibly his granddaughter or great-granddaughter. The repercussions and possibilities are almost beyond our thinking. These are not fantasies, they are today, within the realm of possibility. Today we say, we can detect the sex of an unborn child. Not very accurately, but quite obviously within the next year or so, that will be practicable. But then we are told also that in the foreseeable future, a woman will be able to go to a government laboratory and there say, on regular specification, for the child she wants to bear. She may lay down his IQ, his height, the color of his hair or his eyes, and so on. As in return, we see the small frozen embryo. And if she doesn't want the bother of bringing it up herself, it will be practicable to implant it in an artificial uterus and bring it up outside the human body. These things, I say, are not fantasies. They are within the realm of possibility. We think that today, we know all about genetics. That is rather an exaggerated claim. That is what is being said. We certainly do know that every small human cell, or every cell in the human body, is a small chemical laboratory, each with its own tools and its own code of instructions. Also, we can read the code. We know that the code is made up, not of letters, but of four acids, and as one is used for punctuation. So the possibilities of combination are relatively small. It will read the code. And therefore, issue our own instructions to the cell, not only to correct genetic defects, but also possibly to introduce new genetic features. Ordinary scientists have been talking for some years about the possibility of cloning. Given the nucleus of an adult cell, it would be practicable, eventually, to produce an organism the same characteristics as the donor of the cell. We pause to consider the possibilities of the future. They are somewhat appalling. They certainly ought to concern those who are thinking people. A revolution is going on in the field of biology, which I repeat again, is unequalled in the whole annals of human history. To take a far simpler illustration, isn't there a revolution going on in the field of race? A racist revolt? Well, if you don't believe that, come to my country and view the conditions for yourself. Realize what has been occurring, even during the last few days, and certainly during the last week or two. You must say quite bluntly, we want position for ourselves. We want, we'll take, we'll grab whatever we can get, and it doesn't really matter what other people think. Go to your neighbour and realise what is occurring there. It is being said quite clearly, we no longer want integration. We do not want equality. We want power. And without doubt, sooner or later, that claim is going to be substantiated, or is reinforced, by physical and brutal force. I recall an after case when that sort of thing happened. When one could see cities like Detroit torn to pieces. It will happen again. You realize that 2/3 of the population of Washington, the capital of the state, is black. Realize the implications. Then again listen to the voice of those of that color. We don't want equality. We want power.
The white has had power for so long, it's now the turn of the black. Those are not isolated cases. Go to my country and you see quite clearly what is going to occur in the not too distant future. You go to other countries. The first time I went to Rhodesia, for example, it was a lovely country, peaceful and tranquil. There, no one would dare forecast what the next few months will produce. There's no doubt about it at all. The tribal hatred is going to burst out. Once again, blood is going to be shed. Go to South Africa, and you're there on every side. It's only a question of time. And those in authority are beginning to realize now that the sands are running out. They persuaded themselves for so long that this was avoidable. Nothing really would occur if the show of force was sufficiently strong. That concept has now gone by the ball. It's becoming realized today that inescapably trouble is coming and that many will suffer the loss of life in what is going to occur. Blood is going to be shed on every side. For, incipiently, there is a revolution going on in the hearts and minds of men already. It's only a question of time before it breaks out in literal physical violence. You think I'm exaggerating? Read the Daily Press. And I will give you the answer of the host for it. Take another simple illustration. Isn't there a revolution going on in the field of youth? Now you will think I am an old fossil, won't you? Well, I suppose my birth certificate would confirm that, too. You realize when you were young, that was a terribly long time ago for some of you, wasn't it? There was always a revolution, a hatred of law and discipline and order. Young people have always been like that, but perhaps never on the scale, never to the extent of the present day. When I was young, which again was a terribly long time ago, it was customary on occasion for a child to say please, and on rarer occasions, even thank you. Never heard of such dark ideas today than to say please or thank you. But more seriously, look at what is occurring in the schools, the colleges, the universities. If you bother to read the National Union of Teachers report in my country, about 3 or 4 years ago, you'd have found clear and explicit statements and reports of what was actually occurring, particularly in the East End of London. There, a teacher still takes his or her life in their own hands as they go to school. They don't know what is there is going to bring forth. There have been cases of brutality and of near murder. And this is occurring not with youths of 16 or 17, but with children who are just reaching the teen age. A revolution is going on, of which many parents seem totally unaware. Look at the colleges and universities. It's not so long ago, again in your neighboring country, when you heard it said quite distinctly, we insist on having mixed dormitories. We're not going to accept the rule. The other sex will be excluded after a certain hour at night. We want mixed dormitories. And we'll occupy the administration buildings if our requests are not acceded to. And in one extreme case, we'll decide what lectures will be given and what lecturers will be appointed. And I think in the same particular case, what salaries will be paid. All this seems crazy, doesn't it? But it's going on. And we'll go on to a far greater extent in the not too distant future. The revolt against law and discipline and order, which has always been there, has been accentuated by the conditions of the present day. And there's no doubt whatsoever as what is going to happen in the not too distant future. Of course, young people are saying quite simply, you do not understand. You live in the past. You're not aware of the conditions of the present day. You don't have to do what we do. You're not aware of the instruction we get. You couldn't possibly absorb the knowledge that is imparted to us. And the generation gap, who's always been wise, grows wider and wider still. And in consequence, that spirit of rebellion, of revolt, naturally increases as the gap widens. Don't blind your eyes to what is occurring. It's going to affect your family and you. If you think I'm exaggerating, take a glance around you and see what already has occurred in the lives of families of other people. A revolution is certainly going on in the field of youth. Look at another field. What one might loosely term, I suppose, the theological field. There is a revolution going on there also, isn't there? In my country, Canon Montefiore said on one occasion, some few years ago, in all probability, the Lord Jesus Christ was homosexual. In my boyhood days, he would have been uncrossed. They made him a bishop. A vicar said again, quite clearly, Jesus Christ, quite obviously, was the son of Mary and a soldier. Again, in my boyhood days, he would have been uncrossed. They made him a canon. The annual assembly of the Baptist Union, Dr. Michael Taylor, the principal of the Northern Baptist College at Manchester, a man who's training young men for the ministry, was asked to give a particular address. His views were well known, and he was asked to express his views at the annual assembly. He said quite plainly, of course God was active in Jesus, but it just will not do to say that Jesus is God. No one rebutted his statements. The Baptist Union subsequently reaffirmed this belief. It never went back upon what Dr. Michael Taylor has said, nor did it criticize or condemn. Dr. Taylor is still training young men for the Baptist ministry at the Northern Baptist College at Manchester. Just probably replied, well, of course, that kind of thing cannot affect us. It might apply to other bodies. It couldn't come to us. We are the undenominational denomination. It may affect the sects and denominations. It couldn't affect us. But pause for a moment before you arrive at a conclusion of that kind. Pick up a recent publication in Brethren Circle. Read what is said quite clearly regarding the prophet Isaiah. There were unquestionably three Isaiahs. There's a statement made on four or five different occasions, a quite clear indication of what the author believes. Don't say this kind of thing can't happen here. Pick up another book. Read what it says so clearly. If Jesus Christ is ignorant in one respect, he may have been ignorant of other things as well. Can't it happen here? Don't persuade yourself. Don't shut yourself up in some ivory tower. Say, this kind of thing happens in other circles. It cannot possibly happen to us. Unfortunately, it is happening. I was going to say to us. I don't know who us are. One of my friends says the usites. Anyhow, don't persuade yourself. This kind of thing cannot affect your community. But without a doubt, the atmosphere around us does permeate, does have some effect upon people and upon companies of God's people. Take another glimpse. Look at what one might term the spiritual realm. Is there not a revolution going on there also? Another very great increase in spiritualist churches. Those statistics are published far and wide. Look at another way in which the influence of the unseen is being felt. If you want to write a successful book, or one that will have a very large sale, just put the word occult in the title, and it will sell like hot cake. That's the thing in which people are interested. On the other side, of course, they're interested in tongue speaking. Those two subjects are the two greatest emperors at the present day. Their cult has a far greater appeal even than a charismatic movement or tongue-speaking. And even a Christian, of our reading books, like Rosemary's Baby, and looking at films, going to theatres and seeing plays of similar character, the appeal of the occult is simply tremendous, and the influence consequently upon life and character and outlook is tremendous also. Look at what is occurring in some fields. Since the repeal of the Witchcraft Act in my country, using my country quite deliberately as an illustration, there have been 50,000 witches officially recognized. If you pause to consider the initiation ceremony and realize all the implications, you'll be conscious of some of the dangers. When you are told additionally that some of those witches are young girls at school, of 12 and 13 and 14, you realize also some of the dangers. Witchcraft is spreading today, not only in Britain, but right to the world, and on a scale not seen even in the Middle Ages. Is it dangerous? It's tremendously dangerous. Course to be followed, and one that will have serious repercussions in the not-too-distant future. Talk to the child today. They will tell you that the Ouija board, for example, is no harmless game. Here is something to which they can address a question and receive a reply. And the children who play with the Ouija board know perfectly well that this is a dangerous thing with an influence outside itself. Go to San Francisco. In one residential area, there's a house painted completely black. If you get an entry to that house, you'll be confronted by a curious-looking man called Anton LaVey, the high priest of the Church of Satan. That is the headquarters of that particular church. Read the Satanic Bible and realize some of the implications. It turns the Decalogue upside down. When the Bible says thou shalt, the Satanic Bible says thou shalt not. When the Bible says thou shalt, the Satanic Bible says thou shalt not, and so on. And quite clearly, the Satanic Bible says that one ought to indulge one's desires, cravings, and longings to the full. This is not merely permissible, it's obligatory for any human being. We ought not be bound by old ideas and fetishes. We ought not to think of old standards that are completely antiquated and out of date, but to please ourselves and live as we choose, to judge every desire and every longing. Were you able to attend one of the services at that church, you'd find a nude body of a woman acting as the altar. You'd find subsequently a kind of orgy going on, and you might be horrified by what you saw. Now pause and think. You say, well, that's San Francisco, where you'll find all sorts of curious cults. Satanism is spreading, not only across the USA, but right across the world today. Within 30 miles of where I live, there's a center worshipping Satan. Through France, Belgium, I think in Holland, certainly in Germany, in Italy, in Spain, in Portugal, there are little communities worshipping Satan. And there are more sales of the Satanic Bible in California than there are of the Holy Bible. Follow to read it if you can get a copy. And realize, I say again, the implications. And ask yourself whether a revolution is not going on today that is quite frightening, as one realizes the obvious outcome. Don't blind your eyes to what is happening. The world today is in a state of revolt. Let's take one more illustration. And use the word in rather a different sense, perhaps. But the most obvious sphere which a revolution is going on, is quite patently in the field of science and technology. Now, I realize I am using the word in rather a different sense. It has been said quite frequently that we're reaching a state today unparalleled in history. The Reader's Digest said a few years ago that 90% of the world's leading scientists were alive at that date. Pause for a moment to realize what it meant. 90% of the world's leading scientists throughout the course of history were alive at that particular date. That quite obviously has some justification. What is happening today is almost beyond human comprehension. We are reaching to the heights above and to the depths beneath, and nothing seems impossible to mankind. I think it was Alvin Toffler in his book Future Shock, who said quite simply, people refer to it as the Second Industrial Revolution. That is quite an inappropriate term. And justifiably, Alvin Toffler said, rather one ought to compare it to the emergence of mankind from barbarism into civilization. His words are completely justified. What is happening today has never occurred on this scale, to this extent, in all the centuries of past history. Take a very simple illustration. In 1825, the first steam loco ran in Britain. It ran at the frightening speed of 20 miles an hour. They had to send a man with a red flag in front to warn people that it was coming. Today's satellites orbit this Earth at 20,000 to 30,000 miles an hour. And the possible speeds of the future are always beyond our thinking. About less than four centuries ago, we knew 11 chemical elements. Today we know nearly 10 times that number. At that time, Europe was producing books at the rate of 1,000 a year. Today we produce more than 1,000 a day. And in every possible realm of knowledge, of science, of technology, you'll find the advances made are simply staggering. You pick up a newspaper. You wonder what tomorrow is going to bring forth. What new discovery, what new achievement will have been attained. Almost every day of life there seems some advance in the realm of science. The flood pours out constantly. A boy who's born today may graduate in 20 or 21 years' time. But at the present rate of increase of knowledge, he will then have to know four times as much as he has to know today. According to one estimate, when he lived to 40, then graduated at that age, by that time he would have to know 32 times as much. Don't ask me how that calculation is arrived at. That doesn't seem correct mathematically, but that is the estimate. Knowledge is increasing at such a rate, and in such a vast quantity, if I may put it that way, that the human mind is almost incapable of absorbing the flood that is put out. If you're a business or professional man, you know perfectly well the volume of material, the papers, the magazines, the journals, and so on, that come into your trade, always beyond your capacity to absorb. If you're still a school or college or university, you know quite well that the volume that is put forth, which you have to absorb, is at times almost beyond your capacity to absorb. And young people sit back sometimes. And they say to the older, do you really know? Do you really understand? And you pick up what is being put forth. You try to absorb. And then you find yourself quite incapable. And the flood pours by you, and you watch it flow. And I repeat what And the flood pours by you, and you watch it flow. And I repeat once again, because of your inability to comprehend, to absorb the tremendous flow of knowledge, We who are older are creating a wider and wider gap, generation gap, between old and young. And this is one of those serious problems, not merely in the secular world, but in the Christian world as well today. The gap, which has always been wide, but which unfortunately is becoming wider still. Due in some cases, of course, to the fact that older people are not prepared to sit down and to try to absorb the knowledge that is being put forth. But it is frightening, isn't it? The flow increases in volume almost day by day, and one is almost horrified at the possibility of a future. Dr. Ralph Lapp, who once was a nuclear physicist, but who turned to journalism and made far more money, still on one occasion, is like being on a loco. We're rushing downhill, rapidly gathering speed as we do so. Various tracks open up before us. We just do not know along which track we're going to travel. And there's no hand on the levers. There's no hand on the levers. And nothing can stop it. Nothing can stop it. That, quite bluntly, is the situation of the present day. We're rushing rapidly downhill. There's no hand on the levers. And nothing can stop it. I remember my chief some years ago. He called together mostly young scientists within our organization. He said, things have been going far too fast. Money is short. We now have to control our wealth by our resources. I will decide what should be done. You'll start on a line of research. Normally, of course, you carry on. I will decide how far you'll get. They were brave words. A poor in the wide world is going to stop a young scientist engaged in research. He starts, in some cases he doesn't dare, where the research is going to finish. And although they were brave words, they are totally and completely ineffective. But that is the situation today. There is no one in control. No one who can say, thus far, and no farther. So there, quite plainly, a need arises, urgently and vitally, for someone to take control. Unless someone arises who has the authority and the capacity, the ability to take control and to say, this or this shall not be done, and this shall be done, the whole world is going to be in a state of chaos. Now let your mind travel back to this. On every occasion, in the centuries of the past, when there has been need for a man of a certain caliber or a certain capacity, the various circumstances have called forth the man who was required. In my country, one can think quite simply of the last war. We needed a man of a certain character. One to whom the nation could look up. And there's no doubt whatsoever that Sir Winston Churchill was the man for the job. When his job was done, the populace threw him aside. During the war years, unquestionably, he was the man for the job. That has occurred repeatedly in history. But today, as never before, the world is in need of a man to take control. I was in Brussels some months ago, and I heard the same cry that I've heard time after time. There's no leader. We're in a thorough mess. And Belgium today is in a mess. Not only are there two nations bound together loosely, and incoherently, but they don't cohere. There are Flemish-speaking people and French-speaking people. There's no one to take control. The country is bankrupt. No one to solve the economic and financial problems. Go to France. Just when all the discarded the Stang has done, people are saying quite bluntly, we need a leader. one who's capable of taking control and solving the problem. Go to country after country in Europe, particularly Germany, Western Germany, and our present day. A country once thought would never have been reduced to the situation of the present day. In Western Germany today, the cry is precisely the same. We need a leader, someone to take control. Well, on the basis of past history, one would anticipate that the very circumstances would thrust forth the man who is required. In the very near future, that man must appear. He is needed, vitally and urgently, at the present time.